Okay, our next speaker is Angelia Seyfried.
Close enough.
Close enough. Okay. I'm just really bad with names. Maybe this isn't the best job for me up here. From the University of Delaware.
Great. Don't worry, you're not the first person to not be able to pronounce my name. I'm used to it.
Not that bad.
All right. Well, thank you for sticking around. Of course, everybody's saying that, but the later it gets, the more appreciative we all are, I think. We know that flights are happening tonight. So thanks for sticking around. It's actually a picture of experimental rice paddies that we built at the University of Delaware. I'm not going to talk about that data today, but just to let you know what you are looking at. You can see a picture on the right, some of my students working really hard at those rice paddies in the summer. I want to first acknowledge them, acknowledge the students and postdoc and the funding agencies that are making all this work possible as a group that I like to call Team Rice. We also have Team Estuary, which I won't talk about today, but go Team Rice for the work I'm going to present today. And so what I'm going to do is as I go through, I like to highlight a few people for the data that they help to contribute to. Without them, none of this would be possible. And I say Team Rice because, as we've heard about today and we probably know, rice is a very important staple food for over half the world's population. It's grown on every habitable continent. And in order to make sure we feed the growing number of people that we'll expect to have, we need to make sure that we have enough food. And we don't have a lot of land on which to grow that food, so we need to do better at improving yields on the land that we currently have. If we look at how rice is typically grown, it's typically grown under flooded conditions, and that's either through rain-fed flooding or through irrigation. So dry season irrigation is a way that we can increase rice yields, but as some of us may know, and some of us know very well, that can exacerbate arsenic entry into the rice paddy system if the water is contaminated with arsenic. But even if the water is not contaminated with arsenic, just flooding paddy fields will lead to arsenic mobilization, and that's ultimately what causes arsenic to decrease yields and also to accumulate to levels that might be of concern to human health in the grains. And so there are ways that people are investigating to decrease arsenic uptake by rice. One of those ways is through water management. So if we don't flood the fields, we can have less arsenic mobilization, but that also might impact yields and also leads to more cadmium uptake in the grains. And so from my point of view, that might not be the best situation moving forward. And so what we're working on are other ways that we can still flood fields but improve yields and decrease arsenic uptake without affecting or perhaps even decreasing cadmium uptake in the grains. So before I show you the data, I just want to highlight a few of the key rhizosphere processes that I'll be relying on for the research efforts that we have. So this is my view of the rhizosphere. We have reduced compounds, particularly reduced iron, reduced arsenic, and also maybe some oxidized arsenic, silicon, phosphorus, all these solutes moving around in soil solution, and they tend to migrate toward plant roots because plants are transpiring, right, pulling water through their system. And so these reduced species meet oxygen that is diffusing out of roots because wetland plants can modify their anatomy essentially to deliver oxygen for root respiration. And when that oxygen encounters iron, it can precipitate abiotically. This can also happen biotically through iron oxidizing bacteria to form an iron plaque rind on the outside of roots, which can sequester arsenic potentially, or be a nice source of arsenic adjacent to plant roots, which could be more available during flooding and reflooding events. So that's happening, but we can't really rely just on iron plaque to sequester arsenic and prevent its uptake because we know that arsenic is taken up, and it's taken up through roots of roots, meaning R-O-U-T-E, of uptake for needed plant nutrients. And so the two most dominant inorganic forms of arsenic in rice paddy soil solution, arsenic 5 and arsenic 3, look chemically very similar to dissolved silicon or dissolved phosphorus. Because arsenic 3 is the most common species in most flooded rice paddies, and that's what I'm focusing on, and it's taken up through the silicon transport pathway. But because they're also chemically similar, they also compete for sorption sites onto iron minerals, like the minerals that form iron plaque. And so I'll be focusing on basically this area of this process. Okay, so rice is an efficient silicon accumulator. Most wetland monocots accumulate a tremendous amount of silicon through a very efficient system. And if we give more silicon to rice plants, there is more yield. And this has been known for some time. We also know that if you grow rice in soils with increasing amounts of plant-available silicon, we can decrease the grain arsenic concentrations. But most of the rice that's grown in the world is grown in soils that have actually undergone extensive desilication. So through the process of soil development and weathering, we lose plant-available silicon as the soils get older. And so most of the soils that are used for rice production are ultisols, maybe even some oxisols, in South and Southeast Asia. Now in California and in some parts of Arkansas, we might have more vertisols where they're more silicon replete. So this could potentially be playing into the story of the difference we see between arsenic speciation and concentration in Asian versus U.S. rice. But definitely we can do better, especially for South and Southeast Asia, of trying to put more silicon into the soil. Typically what's the practice typically is removing these very efficient silicon accumulators and the parts of the plant that accumulate the silicon, the straw and the husk, from the fields, and it's decoupled from the soil environment, so it just exacerbates this process of desilication. In a natural wetland environment, that plant residue would be recycled, and so in wetland environments, this recycling of plant tissue is really important for global silicon cycling. But in rice paddies, that doesn't typically occur. If you drive around in Cambodia, and this is probably true for many other rice-growing regions, you see giant piles of rice husk that are typically adjacent to rice mills, and this material is really seen as a nuisance by many farmers. When the farmer harvests the rice, they take the rough rice, so the rice grain that has the inedible husk around it, to the mill. It gets processed. The rice gets polished and then packaged for market, and the husk is left over. So some of that material can be utilized on site and burned for a fuel source to fuel the machinery that dehusks the rice, or sent to other places that would make bricks. But typically this material, which is silicon rich, or this material, which is silicon rich, is underutilized. And there's lots of engineering approaches to use this material, I think mostly because people are trying to find ways to get rid of it. But when I see it, I see it as a very potentially rich source of silicon that can be reincorporated back into soil. So I had a student, Evanice Pinedo. She was a visiting student from UFLA in Brazil. She came to the University of Delaware in need of a project, and so what we decided to do was to incorporate some of these materials, these silicon-rich residues, into soil to see what would happen without plants. And this is just a summary of this study. If we add straw, which is also a silicon-rich residue, to rice, we see a lot of methane formation. We're basically adding labile carbon to the system, promoting methanogenesis. And we also get more arsenic release, and that could be either coming from the straw itself. There's more arsenic in the straw tissue than, say, in the husk tissue. Or it could just be mobilization from the soil itself. And we're not really sure, but we know we get more of it. Even though we get some silicon, this straw, we really think, is not a great option for sustainable rice production. But if you look at the husk, we actually get more silicon, a little bit of methane. We're still adding a little labile carbon, but certainly not as much as the straw, and even some phosphorus. And then with the ash, of course, all that carbon has been burned off and certainly emitted to the atmosphere in terms of carbon dioxide, which is also not a great thing, but since it already exists, we decided we'd use that material to see what impact it had on when we actually grow plants in these soils. So we do get a little silicon, but certainly not as much as the husk. We grew plants in flooded soils, and I'm going to show you data from a pot study where we just took an ultrasol from the University of Delaware, which has about 18 milligram per kilogram of arsenic in it, and it's similar to the range of arsenic content that we find in Cambodian soils and Cambodian rice paddy soils. We added the fresh husk, which is the FH, or the rice husk ash, which is RHA, and so you'll see these acronyms throughout the talk, so you'll know what they are, hopefully. And we wanted to see what would happen when we actually grow rice in them. This is Ratan Gill. She's currently a PhD student at the University of Guelph, but she was my research assistant for some time and helped to do a lot of these plant studies in the background arsenic experiments. And down here we have some yield data. So what we see is that in terms of the total number of grains, we don't see an effect, but the percentage of those that were unfilled was much lower when we add the ash to the soil. So the husk doesn't have an effect on yield, but the ash actually improves yield when we have background arsenic levels. In more recent experiments that we've done, this is Fred Teasley, who's my current master's student, and if you missed his poster yesterday, I thought I'd just summarize a little bit here. He did present a poster on this data, but what's very striking is that under elevated soil arsenic conditions, we see a very big impact on yield, much more yield in either ash or fresh husk amended soils when we compare to control where we don't have any additional silicon and also to a calcium silicate silicon source. So definitely a much stronger yield effect when we're under elevated arsenic conditions. But back to the background arsenic conditions, I think probably most important result that we find is that when we add husk, we see between a 25 to 50% decrease in the inorganic arsenic in the grains. That's huge. That translates directly to human health. The inorganic arsenic is more acutely toxic than the organic forms. And if we can decrease the inorganic arsenic in the grains, we're doing a great job. And so this, of course, is a pot study and there are limitations. We're showing that it happens in three different varieties of rice. And so it holds a lot of promise. And so this is something that we're actively pursuing both in our experimental rice paddy plots and hopefully eventually to rice fields in Asia. But definitely has some promise. And I don't have a slide here. It's at the end. If you're interested, we also show that it doesn't affect cadmium levels in the grains or even decreases cadmium in the grains. In terms of the pore water silicon concentration, we do see these logarithmic decrease in inorganic grain arsenic with increased pore water silicon. So the more silicon that the plants are exposed to, the less arsenic, inorganic arsenic in the grains. And the mechanism by which this is happening is probably due to a few components. One, of course, is a plant component, right? So the transporters that transport silicon and also arsenic-3 can be induced by external concentrations. So the higher silicon concentrations we have, the less energy the plant needs to expend to make more transporters. So we could just have less transporters that transport both silicon and arsenic when we have high silicon concentrations. And this is something that we're looking at. But it also could be a result of soil processes. And one of those things is the amount and or composition of iron minerals that are forming. Is that? Am I not?
Yeah, 2 minutes.
2 minutes, okay. So what we see is that if we just look at the total amount of iron in the plaque for a CBD extract of the roots, we see the more iron we have in plaque, the less we have in the grain of arsenic. But this is actually is just a difference in the rice cultivar. So this cultivar has a wide range of iron in the plaque and a very limited range of grain arsenic, whereas these two cultivars, very wide range of grain arsenic, and very little iron in the plaque. So really, we think it has a lot more to do with what impact the silicon is having on the mineral composition. If we look at the different varieties, the more silicon we have in the plaque, the less transfer of arsenic we have to the shoots, to the above-ground tissue. And the highest silicon in the plaque is our husk amendment, which showed a lot of promise for decreasing inorganic arsenic. We know that if we add just a little bit of silicon to a pretty pure system, we can have a tremendous impact on the crystallinity of the iron minerals that form. And so my almost last slide, Douglas, who's a Sandwich PhD student with me, is looking at the iron minerals that are forming on in the plaque. And what we see is that with the husk treatments, we actually have a little bit more ferrihydrite. And so we think that the silicon is promoting more ferrihydrite formation, which can sorb more arsenic. And so we'd like to do more studies on that to see how much that arsenic is retained over time. And so just in summary, we think that the silicon can improve both rice quantity by increasing yield and also rice quality by decreasing arsenic in the grains. What country are you from? China? Okay, South China, yeah. And what we find is that the practices in different countries and different, within each country, different regions vary widely. So, yeah, it'd be nice to talk with you more about that. Thanks.
Thanks, Angela.